Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm happy to have as my guest Elmore Leonard, whose new book, Mr. Paradise, has just been published by Morrow. I am wondering, because in this book, we've got a real mob of peculiar folk clustering around the pages, and it doesn't let up. I mean, there are new characters dropped into this narrative as late as 70 pages before the end of the book. We're still being introduced to new gangs. And it seems as if because of Get Shorty and Jackie Brown and movies that have been based on your books, that people know that they're going in there to meet a whole town full of extremely idiosyncratic characters. Has that become your emphasis? That wasn't the way you started, is what I mean, and
I thought it was a new way. Perhaps not when I was doing Westerns in the 50s, but I decided that I wanted to put the emphasis on the characters and not the plot. That if I assemble some interesting enough characters, I can make up the story as I go along, which is what I do. In 1956 or 57, I was in New York, and I had sold a story to the Saturday Evening Post, and I visited my agent, and Erd Brandt, who was the fiction editor of the Post, was in her office, and he had just bought one, and he had just turned another one down, and he said, "The bad guy in this book is made of wood. I wasn't interested in him at all." And I said, "Well, he was real. He is real. I know that guy." And Erd Brandt said, "Real? You meet somebody in a magazine that you don't care for, that is uninteresting, you turn the page." And I remember the gesture he made. And I thought, I've got to make all the characters interesting. And so that's been my goal for 50 years.
How do you strike a character to live on the page, and do you know when they've succeeded?
Well, they begin to me as stock. They begin as types, and then as I add to them, and I learn from them. They're in scenes. They sort of audition in the early scenes, and maybe the character will make it, and maybe he won't.
So in other words, the books become like a pinball machine.
Yeah.
The characters are caroming against each other, and if one sparks the other to greater feats, that will be the new direction.
Exactly. And there's always a sleeper. There's a character who kind of comes along, and then I'll notice this character who perhaps in his first appearance didn't even have a name, but had to be there to deliver a message or something. And then later on, he's in a scene, and I like the way he talks. And then before you know it, he's turning the plot. I just let it happen. Because once I assemble the characters, and I'll have, for example, in Mr. Paradise, I have Frank Delson, the homicide cops. I have Kelly, who is a Kelly Barr, who is a witness, possibly more than a witness. She's a model. I have Montez Taylor, who was the he was the walking around man for the guy who was murdered, this old 84-year-old guy who was murdered. He used to take him places. He'd take him to ball games. He'd take him to shows and so on. I've got him on a much lesser degree. There's a guy named Lloyd who's a houseman. All right. Then there's Averyn Cohn, who is a lawyer who acts as an agent for two hitmen. So I've got these groups of characters that I can intercut to move the book along.
Now, Averyn turns up, and he seems like, a classic Elmore Leonard character, by which I mean one has learned that hitmen need agents too. This guy is going to get, what is it, 20%, because he says regular agent entertainment can get 10%, but just think, who can I talk about you to? I can't offer your services as assassins to just anyone. It's a rather special client, and I have to feel comfortable, and I'm jeopardizing myself in the process of offering you. 20% is a small cut. Well, of course, he used to be a lawyer.
He can't advertise like those personal injury guys.
Yeah.
And then one of the hitmen says, well, what about ordinary people? This is when he says that. And the guy says, you know, there are a lot of ordinary people. How about all these women that get beat up every time their husband gets drunk? And so they discuss it to some degree, and that his 20% is off the top. But primarily they're gonna whack bad guys who shoot each other anyway, you know. That's the idea. Averin Cohn, by the way, is a federal judge in Detroit, and he bid on getting his name in the book, which was
one of those deals? One of those, auctioning.
Auctioning off the, and he won.
Wow.
And they were raising money for the Detroit Institute of Arts.
Did he have any say about what
character? No, I told him. I said, you know you're going to be a bad guy. I said, you know that. And he said, yeah, I know. He didn't know he was going to be an agent.
An agent for hitmen. So it does seem as if, well, every 20, 30 pages or so, there's a character who, like Bugs Bunny putting on a disguise, comes into the book and is really essentially pulling stunts. Because, you know, a hitman's agent who speaks consolingly to a potential client about the opportunity to redress your injuries and the solace it will give you, as if he were some newfangled undertaker. It's kind of a specialty turn. This is what character actors were for.
Yeah,
and for me...
Exactly. and he says, you're going to have leisure time in between. Have you considered, maybe you should consider home invasions?
Do you gather them before the book? Do you know who's waiting in the wings?
Well... No, I didn't. I didn't know I didn't know Averin Cohn was going to be an agent. I didn't know who the two hitmen were going to be. But I thought, I'm going to make them the kinds of people who you'd never notice. They're just guys. They're just working men types. One guy's a bricklayer, and the other guy did work for the mafia in Detroit. But they're not very successful, and all he did was collect from bookmakers. But they had been in prison at the same time, so Averin Cohn got them together when this idea came to him of being an agent for hitmen, representing hitmen.
Now, one of them, as said, is a bricklayer, and although he never liked patios where you had to have too many calculations about the fancy brickwork, he does evaluate truth situations according to how things stand when you put things next to each other the way you would bricks, logically. And so that's a Dickens character, in other words, you know, someone who's got a trait that gets used. But the two of them seem cast from an entirely different book. We're told about them that they're like the people who leave work at the beginning of deer season.
Yeah.
And what they are hunters, but they've been cast as killers. And there they are. They don't really know a lot about their trade. In fact, they're frequently guessing with one another what the nature of their jobs might be.
Well, and Art Krupa, who had worked for the mafia, says to Carl Fontana, he says, well, how do you figure this out? What's going on? And they're both dumb. But Carl Fontana says, it's like laying bricks. And they're all serious. You know, the reader has to recognize that no one's trying to be funny.
Well, it's funny because they're not trying.
Yeah.
And that seems to me to be the essence of comic writing. And outside of a writer that I particularly like named Charles Portis, who lives in Arkansas, you seem to be the practitioner of, you know, poker-faced comedy. Do you know, it would seem to me by this point they'd have caught on and would be talking about you as much as a humor writer as of a thriller writer. Are you as interested in humor?
No. I like humor the way I produce it. I said to Barry Sonnenfeld, who directed Get Shorty, and this picture was advertised as a comedy. And I said, I don't write comedy. He said, I know you don't, but it's a funny book. And I said to him a year before he went into production, at least a year before, I hope that when someone delivers a funny line, you don't cut to another character to get a reaction, because they're deadly serious.
But it does seem to me that there is a morality in these books that does have something to do with having a sense of humor.
I'm not sure if I understand that.
Well, I know that you don't judge your characters and that you're famous for that. And yet, I keep getting the sense, at least in Mr. Paradise, for instance, Kelly is ultimately a very good girl, and Delta, who she'll end up with, they are made for each other. They know it virtually as soon as they meet. He knows it and evades her attentions because he isn't sure what she's asking when she asks how long he's been without a partner.
Yeah.
He knows it just as well and has to remind himself that she's a witness and therefore not to move too quickly at the very least, because homicide is a serious thing. But you get the sense as these characters move toward each other that they're moving toward each other because they're the best characters in the book. That they have a morality.
Yeah.
Do they get each other because they've been good?
I never thought of it that way at all, no. They're the stars. That's why they get each other.
Yeah. And the stars have never done anything too bad or they wouldn't be stars.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
When I started reading you, I thought, well, these characters, they're inventions, they're fiction. And then I got the sense, especially after you'd been several of the books had been made into movies, directed by people like Tarantino, played by great eccentric actors, I began to sense that there was a percentage, small, of the population who took it upon themselves to become Elmore Leonard characters in life, that they, you know, that in peculiar ways that these books might be becoming instruction manuals for a certain kind of mild-mannered maniac who has, on the one hand, a hobby like bricklaying, but on the other hand, a job to do like Hitman. And they become Elmore Leonard characters in the process of working out their ways in the world. Then Elmore Leonard sees them and recaptures them.
I don't know. Because they're not apt to read me to begin with, you know?
Now, who is, though? You say that. You say you're not read in prisons.
I am read in prisons now, that I have these people who are pushing me. The readers, the serious readers are pushing me. But, no, not... I don't think many criminals buy books. They're too expensive, for one thing.
Well, who are the readers? I don't know about them.
I don't know who the readers are. They're everybody, but they're not everybody. They're not the ones who jump on a bandwagon like Da Vinci Code, like the Bridges of Madison County, like Grisham when he started out. I think those are all people who seldom, if ever, read. And then they hear about this and say, oh, let's read that. And that's what happens. They are making readers because those books, and I think most books on the bestseller list, are plot-driven. And most readers like plot. They like a lot of story. And I have story, but it just sort of comes along.
It takes a back seat.
It definitely takes a back seat to
and often seems as if it's very negotiable.
Mm-hmm.
If a character comes along who's interested in doing something more interesting, that's where the plot will
go. When I get to page 300 in my manuscript, I start looking at the ending, because most of my manuscripts run 350, 360, so I better start looking at the ending. And there are options. There are all kinds of ways for a book to end, you know. So I decide who's going to remain alive long enough to get to the ending and work it out that way.
Now, I'm very interested in this. As a boy, you read Westerns.
No.
You didn't.
No, I read... Well, I suppose I did to some extent, but I read boy books, Don Sturdy and the Patagonia Giant and other books like that. And I read, but then I got into, because when I was 10 years old, I was reading All Quiet on the Western Front and then wrote a play that was put on at school, World War I play. And didn't write another thing until I was in college, but was reading and deciding what kind of a style. I was reading for to see a way to learn from someone who I felt I had some kind of a rapport with.
But you were working with Westerns and with thrillers, yes? That was the beginning.
I began to write Westerns because of the market.
Right.
Because Westerns were everywhere. Saturday Evening Post, Collier's, men's magazines, and then at least a couple of dozen more pulp magazines. The better ones paying 2 cents a word.
Now, I would think that if there were anything that was going to shape a writer in our time, it would be what happened to the Western. Because you had one of the most popular genres in the world in terms of pulp fiction, short films, feature films, dwindle in its popularity and then in the kind of words that it was permissible to use. We started thinking about these encounters in very different ways than they'd been thought of at first. So it seems to me that the writer there is living in a world that's changing, and his writing is reflecting that. Now, you have recently published some of the Western writing, and you still do it, as I understand it.
This year, we're going to have a book, the complete list of my Westerns, 32 short stories. And most of them I got $100 for, 2 cents a word. 310 to Yuma I got $90 for. It was 4,500 words. I had to write one scene 3 times. I thought, why am I doing this for $90? You know, rewriting this scene to get more of my senses, or the reader's senses, into the description. But it was worth it. It was worth it.
Now, if you were to write a Western today, could you? Is there an audience?
I could, yeah. Well, I wrote Cuba Libre, which is a Cuban Western.
Right.
1898, and that's right up to the end of the period.
But you no longer can have Indians versus cowboys.
No.
Not in those ways. We've become more sophisticated. We've become more moral. And so what I think of you as between Westerns and thrillers, places where you're writing about people in the street, you're writing current social history, and your obligation is to be both accurate and at the same time not to be so flamboyant that you create a level of violence in the books that people feel tempted by, I think.
Mm-hmm. Tempted by.
Well, don't you sometimes find yourself reading some of these books and feeling that the writer is really parading a devil's gallery of excesses to delight the reader that, you know, the bad guy has all the lines.
I know. No question about it. That's right. I don't know. My next book sort of combines the two because it takes place in Oklahoma in the 30s. And because I remember that period, this is the period between the ages of 5 and 10, an impressionable time when Bonnie and Clyde and Pretty Boy Floyd and Dillinger and so on were all in the news constantly. And I'm into the book. I've developed a character who is the son of Virgil Webster, the Marine who was on the Maine when it blew up and was blown off into the plot. Virgil comes home with his son Carlos and a Cuban wife who dies giving birth to Carlos. And Carlos grows up to be a deputy United States Marshal whose ambition is to be the most famous lawman in the country. And then we'll see another guy grow up through an oil family who wants to be the most famous outlaw in the country. And they will meet somewhere. I don't know where.
It's very thrilling to me because these began as morality tales. They become kind of cynical morality tales, you know, tales of the debauched city. And we stop reading them for their return to moral virtue. But I always think that they are still, and I guess I'm harping on this, a report about what happened to virtue. I gather Ann Beattie writing about Mr. Paradise accuses you perhaps of bringing a Miltonic vision of paradise onto the page, but it still does strike me that that is not necessarily so ridiculous. These books ultimately are about who is punished and who's redeemed.
This is what she points out in the review, that it's good versus evil.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, that's what all writing is, good versus evil, in varying degrees.
Is it an issue that concerns
you? I don't think of why I write or what I'm... No, I just think of story. Because in the very beginning, I wanted to become a successful commercial writer. And that's what I've become. And it is commercial. I mean, what I write is a story, even though the emphasis is on the characters. But I'm not preaching or teaching. I'm not pointing out anything new to you that I've come up with.
But like your characters, one of whom wants to be the greatest lawman alive and the other the greatest criminal, you do get the sense that you, the third, Elmore Leonard, want to be the greatest teller of the stories, you know, on a commercial level, that this is, that you can assess one's success here. How many people have you put behind bars, you ask the lawman. How many notches on your gun, you ask the outlaw, and how many readers do you have, you ask Elmore Leonard, or how many languages are they translated in?
Yeah. Well, I've been writing for 52 years, and I'm still, and it gets harder, because I don't want to repeat myself, although I probably do, but I don't want to repeat myself. I'm still trying to make it better. I'm still trying things.
It seems to me that suddenly, when Eudora Welty wrote about Ross McDonald on the front page of the New York Times Book Review, it became possible for serious readers to read Ross McDonald. Mm-hmm. When Leonard Michels wrote what I thought was a terrific essay about you, also on the front page of the New York Times Book Review, it became possible for intellectuals to at least carry these books in public. I suspect that they were reading them before that. What effect has that kind of audience had on you as a writer? Is it an audience you wanted? Were you courting them? Did it come as a surprise, that literary audience?
It has no effect because I continue to do what I've set out to do, still trying to make it better. I'm so happy that I am recognized by people who know writing, who do read good writers. Martin Amis comes to mind. He's been my biggest cheerleader. The first time I saw my name linked with his, when he said in The New Yorker, I think, in an interview, he was asked, well, what American writers do you read? And he said, Don DeLillo and Elmore Leonard. And that's the first time I've ever had my name close to Don DeLillo. I thought, oh, my God. I couldn't believe it, you know? But he says that the way I write, it's always in tune. What does it say? What's the word? That it's pitch perfect. That it's consistently pitch perfect.
Now, since you say that you don't hang out, to what do you attribute the perfection of that pitch?
Well, I think it's anyone's language. Anyone of a certain education level, because none of my characters is smarter than I am. I have to be careful about that, you know. I can handle them. And I do. And that's it. And they could be working men. They could be, well, that's what they are. They're blue collar. All my characters pretty much are blue collar.
And the perfect pitch, where does it come from?
Well, I think of thinking of the writing in a rhythmic way I'll go over it. I write in longhand, but I'll write maybe 4 or 5 pages to get one, just to get that, the flow, the rhythm of it. And people will ask me at a signing, they say, you like jazz, don't you? I say, yeah, how do you know that? And they say, well, you can see it in your writing. So a book was signed to me last week calling me the Elvis Presley of crime writers.
I've been talking with Elmore Leonard, author most recently of Mr. Paradise, published by Morrow. Thank you, Elmore, for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
You can read an excerpt from Mr. Paradise on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistants from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.